This is the NBC Theater. From the NBC Theater in Hollywood, another in the series which holds the Peabody Award for Radio Drama. Today, an hour-long drama based on Thornton Wilder's stimulating and most unusual novel of the last days of Caesar, The Ides of March. The adaptation for radio is by Brainerd Duffield and Emerson Crocker. At intermission, a recorded commentary on the writings of Thornton Wilder by Edward Weeks, editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Here then, The Ides of March by Thornton Wilder.
We are fortunate in having with us today as guest lecturer Professor Willard, who has come down from State University to speak to us on aspects of ancient Rome. Professor Willard.
Thank you. I must begin by telling you that I have devoted 30 years to a study of the correspondence and memoranda of Julius Caesar. So you can imagine my astonishment when last year a vast bulk of highly interesting and I may say unique documents came to light on the island of Capri. It would appear that they were written by Julius Caesar to his friend Lucius Mamilius Turinus in the year 45 BC and indeed on into the next year when they were cut short on the Ides of March. Picture with me now, if you can, that blue Mediterranean world in the last glorious days of the Roman Republic. Picture the marble temples, the dark cypresses, the splashing fountains, and so forth. This, then, is the first letter, dated August 20, the year 45 B.C., some 1,500 years before Columbus. It was written by Caesar, and it reads, "My dear old friend, prepare your thoughts for my guidance. It is midnight."
It is midnight. I sit before my window and look out at the city. I have left my wife sleeping and have tried to quiet my thoughts by reading the poetry of Lucretius. Oh, my friend, every day I feel more pressure upon me, arising from the position I occupy. I am the dictator, but I think a good one. I have pacified the world, I've reformed the calendar, I've extended the benefits of Roman citizenship to innumerable men and women. Next month, torture will be removed from the penal code. Yet still I am much hated. Oh, my friend, what are the capabilities of the human being? Man, what is that? What do we know of him? His gods, liberty, mind, love, destiny, death, what do these mean? You remember how you and I, as boys, studying in Athens and later before our tents in Gaul, used to turn these things over endlessly. I am an adolescent again, philosophizing. As Plato said, the best philosophers in the world are boys with their beards new on their chins. I am a boy again.
Hush.
There has just been a change of guard at my door. The sentries have clashed their swords and exchanged the password. Password for tonight is Caesar watches.
The password for tonight is Caesar watches. I think you students will see that this is rather a remarkable letter, revealing, let us say, the meditative Caesar, who we... Yes, you have a question back there?
Sir, I'd like to ask, who was Turinus?
Who was Turinus? Well, we know of Turinus mostly from Caesar's History of the Belgian Wars. In the second battle with the Belgians in the year 51, the enemy captured Turinus. He had been gone 30 hours before Caesar realized he was missing. They rescued him, but he was in a pitiable state. The enemy, in order to extract information from him, had been progressively cutting off his limbs and depriving him of his senses. They had cut off an arm and a leg, perhaps more, put out his eyes, cropped his ears, and were about to burst his eardrums when Caesar rescued him. After that time, by his own wish, he lived alone in a villa on Capri, absolutely walled off. Yes, well, I shall go on to the second letter, dated September 3rd. My dear friend Turnus, I am putting into this week's packet to you a sheaf of poems.
I want you to tell me what you think of them. They're by a young man named Catullus, and I think the mastership of Rome more worth administering since I've seen these examples of what our Latin tongue can do. This Catullus is as eloquent in hatred as he is in love, and he seems to hate me bitterly. I don't know why. The verses I am sending are written in praise of Clodia Pulcher, that reckless woman who continues to be a daily scandal. Clodia and that abominable brother of hers have invited us to dinner, by the way. Need hardly say we are not attending. Oh, wait. Someone is coming. I must lay down my pen a while. Yes, who is knocking?
It is I, nephew.
My dear Aunt Julia.
Dear boy, forgive me for taking the time of the master of the world. But may I ask you one question?
As many as you like.
It's about this invitation. Clodia Pulcher and her brother have invited me to dinner on the last day of the month. And they tell me, dear boy, that you will be there, too.
My dear aunt, I have no intention of going to Clodia's dinner.
Oh? But Pompeia says that you will go.
My wife said that?
Yes, Caius.
Where is Pompeia?
She's out there in the hall.
I thought as much. Pompeia! Come in here.
You called me, did you, darling? Did you, dear?
Come here to me.
Yes, Caius.
I thought we had decided, you and I, not to go to Clodia's reception.
Oh, had we, Caius?
I must confess, nephew, it surprised me to hear that you were dining with that wicked woman. Why, while I was in the country, I had scandalized letters every day from Sempronia Metalla, Fulvia Manso, and all the other ladies.
I don't care. I want to go to Marcy's party.
Well, really, Pompeia.
I think, Aunt Julia, you'd better let me speak to my wife alone. I thought it had been decided we wouldn't go, but I see we must discuss it further.
Just as you like, nephew. Forgive my presumption.
Pompeia, I'm going to be stern with you.
Oh, Caius.
It makes me unhappy to refuse you anything. Now, three or four times you have listened and agreed and accepted my reasons for not going to Clodia's dinner. You really try my patience.
You don't love me.
Darling, don't I return to you daily from my work with the most affectionate expectation? Don't I pass all the time with you that isn't devoted to my official duties? You know I do.
I don't care. I want to go to Mousy's party.
I wish you wouldn't call her by that name.
She's my Mousy.
Well, call her your panther or your tigress if you like, but in Jove's name, not Mousy.
Are we never to have any enjoyment in our life? Any pleasure at all?
You knew when you married me that my position does not permit the leisure and freedom that most men enjoy. Many women envy you.
I don't care if they do. Every request I put to you, you refuse. I cannot go to the theater. I cannot go to the Temple of Isis and Osiris. I cannot
It's not suitable for you to be seen in such places.
Oh, every morning we quarrel and every night you apologize, but I never make any progress. I never get what I want.
My dear, why are you so set on going to this dreadful dinner?
Well, Marcy, that is, Clodia, had the loveliest dress sent me from Sorrento, and we're to dress as twins at the party, she and I. I've tried on a dress, and it's divine. It just matches my Etruscan tiara.
What other reason do you have for wanting to invade that serpent's nest?
Well, Marcy's promised to serve that Egyptian ragu of seafood, and I'm to have the sheep's head with roast apples and peaches soaked in Albanian spirit.
And there is no other reason?
Well, yes, Caius, of course. The people. There'll be such lovely people there.
Who will be there?
Well, Cicero is invited, and you know how witty he is. And Mousy's brother Clodius will be there.
Yes, I know he will.
And he's a terribly attractive person and so sympathetic, even though he does have such a frightful reputation with the ladies.
Pompeia, if I ever hear of your being more than barely polite to that scoundrel, I shall thrash you, divorce you, and bar you from my house.
Oh, what a thing to say. I'm sure Clodius has always been a perfect gentleman to me.
He's a beast. He's worse than his sister. Avoid him. What other charming people will be there?
Oh, yes, who else? Well, there's Catullus, the young man that writes such clever poetry, and Asinius Pollio.
Are you sure Catullus will be there?
Of course I am. Oh, I know he writes simply horrifying verses about you, dear, but they're awfully clever, you'll have to admit it.
Never mind, my dear. Since you've set your heart on it, we'll go.
May we? Oh, may we, Caius? Oh, I see it all now. Why didn't I tell you in the beginning that the poet would be there?
There. That's enough. Now run along and tell Aunt Julia the news. And write to Claudia, say that we're coming. Oh. Go along. I have a letter to finish. Oh, where did I put that pen?
Oh, you and your letters. Goodbye, my darling Caesar. I do love you.
Goodbye, my dear. I have changed my mind. We shall dine at Claudia Pooker after all. She's a woman of beauty, high birth, and conspicuous intelligence. And when I was young, I was in love with her. Besides, she will introduce me to Catullus.
Besides, she will introduce me to Catullus. And here the letter ends. Now, before I go on, are there questions? Yes?
I would like to ask you, Professor, would you tell us something about Claudia?
Claudia Pulcher.
Yeah.
Well, she was quite notorious, you know. How many here have heard of her? Well, quite a few. And how many know the name Catullus?
Oh.
Ah, yes. Well, for the benefit of those who don't, I shall say that Catullus was a very great poet who addressed his most passionate poetry to Lady Claudia Pulcher, a blasé and dissolute woman. I suppose our modern Freudian psychologists would have an explanation for such a person. She must, sometime in her youth, have had a very unpleasant experience with a man. She led a, let us say, a highly immoral existence. But at any rate, poor Catullus seemed blind to her faults. Although she treated him most cruelly, he worshipped her and did whatever she told him. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Unfortunately, we don't have Caesar's account of Claudia's dinner party on the 30th of September, but we do have the account set down some years later by Asinius Pollio, who was also a guest that evening. In the words of Asinius Pollio...
We had been awaiting the arrival of the dictator and his party, and a large crowd had gathered outside Claudia's house to watch him pass. Then some terrified servants burst in to tell us the news. An attempt had been made on Divine Caesar's life. I must say that Claudia seemed deeply shocked, though from that day to this the people of Rome have believed that she and her brother had hired bullies to waylay and assassinate their guest. I left at once and I found Caesar sitting in a courtyard being treated for his wounds. The physician was washing and binding these with sea moss while Caesar sat there jesting.
Good physician, make haste, I shall be late to dinner.
Hail, Caesar, I came as quickly as I could.
Asinius, you are welcome. We shall not be long, I promise you. Ah, there, have you finished?
Sire, I now ask of you absolute quiet and sleep. Will the dictator graciously drink this opiate?
Good physician, I shall obey you in 2 hours. First, Asinius and I have an errand to perform nearby.
Sire, you must not.
I tell you, we must. Asinius, my wife and aunt dare not venture forth again, but you and I must keep our dinner engagement with Lady Claudia Pulcher and her guests.
As you wish, sire.
Oh, here, my friend. Have you seen this leaflet?
Let me look at it. To every Roman worthy of his ancestors, prepare to shake off tyranny. Death to Caesar. Yes, master, I have seen these. They are scattered all about the city.
The men who attacked me have been captured, and with them a dozen of these pamphlets.
Signed, the Committee of 20.
Yes. My secret police, for all their interesting methods, have not been able to arrest this committee. But at least we know the author of the pamphlet. His rooms are searched. The original copies found there.
Who is this man?
The young poet we're going to meet this evening.
Not Catullus.
That is his name. Do you understand why I am so eager to make his acquaintance?
Sire, let me imprison him. Put him to the torture.
No. I have reason for wanting him alive. Give me your arm, Asinius. You soldiers, go before and clear the Palatine Way.
As we drew near to Claudia's house, we could see that the police were trying to disperse the crowd. Caesar walked toward them smiling, and when they saw him, a cry went up.
Roman! May the gods preserve Rome and all who love her. Your enemies have attempted to take my life, but I am still among you, capable and earnest to serve your welfare.
Your enemies have attempted to take my life. But I am still among you, capable and earnest to serve your welfare. Return to your homes, draw your wives and your children about you, and give thanks to the gods. Then sleep well. A measure of wheat shall be given to every father, that he and his may rejoice with me. Go quietly to your homes, my friends.
We went into the house where Clodion and Catulla stood waiting. The other guests, and with them her brother, had fled by the back door for fear of the mob.
Welcome, great Caesar.
My dear Clodia Pulcher, forgive me for being so very late. I must apologize for the absence of my wife and aunt. They have been unavoidably detained.
I, too, must apologize for the absence of Clodius, my brother. He was unexpectedly called away.
Mm. And this is Catullus.
Yes, this is the poet. He is still here. He is always with me.
Good evening, dictator.
Good evening, poet. Clodia, surely the dinner is not all spoiled. You can order us one dish, and while it is prepared, we can begin with our drinking.
It shall be done.
Asinius, fill our cups.
Yes, sire.
I see, Clodia, that you are prepared for dinner in the Greek manner. That is well. After we dine, we shall have a feast of talk, also in the manner of the Greeks. For the company is well chosen, and there's no lack of subjects for discussion.
You are the master, Caesar. Let the music begin.
I poured the wine, and dinner was begun. My opinion of Clodia Pulcher had never been as harsh as that held by the majority of our community. And never did I have occasion to admire her more than on that evening. Her house was in disorder. Her brother had fled. And she herself lay under suspicion of having planned the attempt on the dictator's life. Yet she remained serene. Her famous beauty seemed enhanced by the danger she was in. Finally, the tables were withdrawn, and Caesar rose and placed a garland on his head.
The subject of our symposium shall be whether great poetry is the work of men's minds only, or whether, as some have claimed, it is the prompting of the gods. Before we begin, let us hear some verses, that we may be reminded of the matter before us. Catullus, you are a poet. You will read.
You know my verses, Caesar?
I know them all by heart.
They are not always kind, Caesar.
No.
You are not angry?
I am not angry. Come, boy, recite to us.
What shall it be, then?
Speak for me the verses that begin, O immortal gods, if pity be.
O immortal gods, if pity be among your attributes, or if ever you have brought supreme aid to one already at the point of death, turn your eyes upon me, a most wretched man. And if I have lived a pure life, tear out from my heart this plague, this pestilence which, stealing like a lethargy throughout my deepest fibers, has driven all joy from my breast. I no longer ask that this woman return my love, nor, for that is impossible, that she be chaste. All I aspire to is that I be healed, and that this black malady be removed. Oh, immortal gods, grant this in return for my devotion.
Well done. You speak most movingly. And now, dear Clodia, the first speech of the evening falls to you.
So be it. If it be true, O Caesar, that poetry comes among us at the prompting of the gods, then we are indeed miserable. For poetry puts a fairer face on life than life can claim to. It is the most seductive of lies and the most treacherous of counselors.
No. Be quiet. Let us speak.
Without poetry to beguile them, men would go into battle. Brides would enter marriage. Wives would become mothers. Men would bury their dead and themselves die in misery and discord. But drunk on poetry, men and women rush toward these events with I know not what unbounded expectations. Now, it is very certain that poetry is only flattery. It puts to sleep the springs of action. It is an evil. It weakens weakness and redoubles misery.
I will not allow you to say such things.
Hush, boy, let us speak.
And, as be the poets, feverish dreamers, Poets are men like ourselves, but they are ill and suffering. I pity and despise them.
I must praise you for your eloquence, Clodia. But you have made our young friend angry. And since I disagree with you, I shall answer for him by telling you the legend of Alcestis. Now everyone knows that Alcestis, wife of Admetus, king of Thessaly, was the golden pattern of all wives. As a girl, however, marriage was the last thing she wanted. Her heart was filled with one ambition, to become a priestess of Apollo at Delphi. One day a soothsayer revealed to her that by the will of Jupiter, Apollo had come to live on Earth as a man among men. And Apollo had chosen to live as a herdsman outside her very gate. Toward the end of that day, when the stars were first appearing, Alcestis slipped from the palace and went to where five herdsmen were sitting about a fire. She stood at the edge of the firelight and besought Apollo to speak to her and answer the question that was her very life. The shepherds were bewildered. Finally, the oldest of them spoke and said, "Princess, if there be a god here, I do not know which it is. For 30 days we've walked together, drunk from the same wineskin, slept by the same fire. Yet, lady, this I shall say, these are no ordinary herdsmen. That fellow that's asleep, there's no illness he can't cure, snake bite or broken bones. Yet in one town a child lay dying, and he would not cross the road to save her. So I know well that he's no god. Now that fellow beside him, that... Can't you stop drinking while the princess is looking at you? He never loses his way. In the darkest night, he knows his north from his south. But that is his only talent, and I know well that he's not the god of the sun. And the red-haired one, he's no ordinary herdsman either. He performs miracles and wonders. He makes water fall from the treetops and balls of fire race along the ground. But he's ashamed of his tricks, and he knows not how he does them. Would a god be ashamed of his miracles? But Alcestis would not be put off so easily. She pointed to the fourth herdsman. That man, said the old one, he is our singer. Oh, believe me, when he plays his lyre and sings, lions hang suspended in their leap. He can fill us to the brim with joy or sorrow, when there's no reason to rejoice or grieve. He can make the memory of love more tender than love itself. And then...
And then...
Yes, Caesar, go on. What happened then?
Caesar, are you ill?
The herdsman said. But he soon rejects the song he has made. He loses joy in the thing he has done. And Alcestis cried, "This is Apollo! This is the god!" I can't go on. I am ill, Asthenius. Please, take me home.
Master.
He had scarcely said the words when Caesar fell to the floor in a convulsion of pain. Whether from the wound he had had or from the fevers that his brain was sometimes subject to, I cannot say. When the agony was over and he fell into a deep sleep, I heard the poet say,
"Why did you lie to me about this man? Why did you teach me to hate him? I know him now. He's a different man than I thought him to be."
We watched beside Caesar for a time, then placed him in his litter, and the poet and I accompanied him to his home.
And the poet and I accompanied him to his home. That is the account of the banquet as set down by Asinius. Now, before I begin the second part of my lecture, I should like to put my notes in order. So, if any of you would care to take a moment or two to step outside for a smoke, you may feel free to do so.
He's a funny old crud, but it's an interesting lecture.
You think so? Yeah. Frankly, I'm bored to death. I don't know why I ever took this course. Let's go and have a smoke.
Sure.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater is bringing you a radio version of The Ides of March by Thornton Wilder. If you're interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these NBC Theater productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement at the close of this program. And now, our intermission commentator, Mr. Edward Weeks.
Thornton Wilder is one of those exceptional writers who knew even before he was 21 where he wanted to go. Before he graduated from Yale, Rome had become the capital of his imagination, and he meant to go to Rome and write about it just as soon as he had the money. He won a scholarship to the American Academy in Rome, and that scholarship gave him two wonderfully impressionable years in the ancient city, whose history and whose beauty he took in through his eyes and his mind. The Ides of March, which I count as Mr. Wilder's finest prose, is a novel about Rome in the days of its magnificence. The novel is centered in Rome in the autumn of the year 45 B.C., which was the last year in the reign of Julius Caesar. The story comes to us as if it had been pieced together and ferreted out by a remarkable historian who had access to everything that was happening in Rome during those crucial months leading up to Caesar's assassination. So, here are Caesar's letters, and here are the private reports of Caesar's FBI, who knew perfectly well that the conspirators were already working for Caesar's death. Here are the love notes which pass between Caesar and Cleopatra, and here is the backstairs gossip which Cleopatra's spies reported to her. Here are the poems of the poet Catullus, and the nasty jingles which were scrawled on the walls and in the public baths. Here are the ironic comments of Cicero, and most moving of all, here are Caesar's long epistles to his best friend Lucius. Lucius came back from the wars a cripple, and Caesar always thinks of him with tenderness and confides to him his innermost thoughts. Caesar, of course, is the diamond of this book. He is 56 years old, the most powerful man in the Roman world, and at times the most lonely. Mr. Wilder, through his imaginary historian, turns Caesar this way and that so that we see the brilliant facets of his character. We see the unhealed grief which is in his heart for his daughter Julia, who died. We see his clemency towards those who have tried to harm him, and the calmness with which he reads the reports his spies bring him about the conspirators. We see his infatuation for Cleopatra and at the same time his contempt for the corruption in Rome. We see the humility with which he searches for the truth of religion. We see his loneliness. We see how he has to struggle against epilepsy, the illness which is making him weaker. And in his letters of self-revelation to his dearest friend, we see his wisdom and warmth and nobility. One may question whether the real Caesar was as noble as this, but I'm sure the novelist, Mr. Wilder, is right in his overemphasis. For me, the Julius Caesar which Thornton Wilder and his imaginary historian have created has a heart and a stature bigger than I have found in Shakespeare or Edward Gibbon or in Caesar's own text.
Thank you, Mr. Weeks. Our radio version of the Ides of March will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
Before resuming our examination of the letters written by Julius Caesar to Lucius Mamilius Turnus, I think I should tell you that these were days of exceptional brilliance for the Republic of Rome. On October 7th of that year, this celebrated Brutus returned to the city after a year of foreign service as governor general subjugating the barbarians in southern France. And on October the 10th, just 3 days later, Cleopatra, Queen of Egypt and Empress of the Nile, arrived in Rome with all due pomp and ceremony to take up residence in a villa on the far side of the Tiber. Yet, strangely enough, in the letter he wrote that week to his friend on the island of Capri, Caesar makes no mention of the youthful Brutus, nor indeed of the Egyptian queen.
I count great poetry the topmost achievement of man's powers. Oh, to be understood by such a one as Catullus, and to be celebrated by his hand in verses that would not soon be forgotten. And yet he has chosen to glorify Clodia Pulcher, to waste his life and his song for the favors of a harlot, whose beauty now because of him shall be immortal. Not long ago there was a plot against my life, and since that time, although against my wishes, the secret police have posted spies within her house. Thus I have come to see reports about their quarrels.
She upbraids him constantly and treats him as if he were a child. She has often called him to his face an hysterical child.
It is too boring to have to deal with an hysterical child. Never try to see me again.
You have betrayed me. You've broken your promise.
I will not be spoken to in such a fashion. I have broken no promises because I made none. I shall live as I choose.
You've always been unfaithful. You always lied to me.
You know that I never lie, and that I do not permit people to tell lies in my presence. I have been, as you call it, unfaithful to you on numerous occasions. I do not sleep well at night, and so I arrange for companionship.
Claudia! Oh, forgive me. Listen to me this once. Let us go to the country together. We'll be happy there. We shall read, we shall walk by the sea, and there will be no others there.
I tell you that there will always be others. Oh, so let us say goodbye. Goodbye, Catullus. Put me forever out of your mind. Go and do not come and see me again.
No.
All I ask of you is that you go. I want to be rid of all poets and weaklings. Love is a sickness with you, and I have no patience with the sick.
Yes. Yes, I am sick with love. A love like mine must speak. It must cry out. I have worshipped you, made a goddess of you.
Are you insane? From now on, I forbid you my house. You are not to come here again.
Oh, please. Please, we will speak no more. I did not mean to make you so angry. Oh, Claudia, forget the cutting things that we have said to one another. You call me sick. I am. I have been ill. Despised lovers pretend that they are ill, but this is no pretense. Do you wish to kill me? If you no longer give me your love, then I shall surely die.
Die, then. Die. I shall be glad. I shall be glad to see you die.
Then there is one thing I have left to do. I will insult the universe. I will insult it by making a beautiful thing. That I shall do. And then I'll put an end to this crucifixion that has been my life.
When you have done this, I shall think that you were a man.
I have seen reports of what has been said there in that house. Poets before have told us of their sufferings and have been cured. But I have reason to believe that Catullus cannot be cured. He has resigned all hope of health and is letting himself drift into death.
He is letting himself drift into death. Now, students, doesn't that suggest to you that the dictator of all Rome was a man of pity and compassion? But now a word about Cleopatra, the witch of the Nile. As I have said, she and Caesar were something more than friends. Cleopatra, although a deceitful, intriguing person and a light-hearted murderess, was nevertheless a remarkable girl with an active mind, a nimble wit, and a genius for administration. It was therefore altogether proper that her arrival in Rome should be celebrated with a magnificent reception. But there was, so to speak, one fly in the ointment. Julius Caesar did not arrive at his appointed hour. We have the word of Asinius Pollio, who says, "The dictator was late to the reception for the Queen of Egypt, and I observed this made her angry."
How is it that the great Caesar does not attend our banquet?
Majesty, I cannot say. I have no doubt that affairs of state have kept him at the capital.
If Her Majesty wishes.
Yes. Who is this?
Allow me to present Your Majesty, the Lady Claudia Pulcher.
Yes, Your Ladyship. If Her Majesty pleases, I can tell her where Caesar may be found.
Can you indeed?
Yes, Majesty. A servant of mine has brought word that the dictator was seen an hour ago, sitting beside the sickbed of Catullus.
Who is Catullus?
He is a poet, Majesty. A revolutionist who has sometimes written verses against our Caesar.
I find it hard to credit this report, my lady, that your leader should be in attendance at the sickbed of some versifier while I expect him here. This is discourteous of Caesar.
Your Majesty, doubtless there is some other explanation. Our great leader himself will be here soon, I'm sure, to offer his apology.
But it is growing late. They've lighted all the torches. Who is to escort me to the water pageant? I am a queen. I am not used to this waiting.
Your Majesty, if I may suggest, Caesar's nephew is close by. He has asked me to present him to you. He has been a great admirer of your Majesty's beauty.
Caesar's nephew, did you say?
He is here, Majesty. Let me present him.
Come forward, young man.
Your Majesty.
Yes. He is a fine young man. I am very glad to know him.
Your Majesty is most kind.
Will you take your uncle's place tonight and sit beside me on the throne?
I should be greatly honored.
Then you shall do so. What is your name, young man?
My queen. In Rome, they call me Mark Antony.
I will remember. Take my arm, young man.
I am watching beside the bed of a dying friend, the poet Catullus. From time to time, he falls asleep. I then take up my pen and write. Not as much to record my thoughts as to avoid reflection. Death is inevitable, and I can now tell at a glance those men who have not yet foreseen their death. And I know them for the children that they are. They think by evading the contemplation of death that they are enhancing the savor of life. But the reverse is true. Only those who are constantly aware of death and darkness are capable of praising the sunlight. Each year I say farewell to the spring with a more intense passion. Because I know my death is certain, nay, momently possible. Wait. Catullus is stirring. He has opened his eyes again. Now he will speak.
Caesar?
Yes, my friend.
Will you read to me my mother's letter? It is by my bedside.
I should be glad.
She is a very simple woman, my mother. Good woman.
I understand, my boy. I'll read it to you. It says, your father has taken on many new duties in the town. He is busy from morning to night. The crops have not been what was expected. Your sister, Ipsitha, had a very bad cold, but is better. Your dogs are well. All Verona knows your poems by heart. Why do you never send them to us? Sicinius' wife brought over 20 of them to us. It is strange that we must receive from a neighbor's hand the one that you wrote about your dear brother's death. Your father carries it with him wherever he goes. I pray daily that the immortal gods may protect you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Another hour has gone by. He is asleep again. You know I am no stranger to deathbeds. I know what one must do. To those in pain, one talks about themselves. To those in clear mind, one praises the world that they are quitting. There is no dignity in leaving a despicable world. And the dying are often fearful lest life was not worth the efforts it had cost them. Yes, I am never short of subjects to praise. He is awake again.
Caesar?
I am here.
Caesar, have I lived in vain? Have I wasted my life?
No. You have written great poetry, Catullus, and the true poet is a country's highest ornament. You have not lived in vain.
Caesar, that night, do you remember when she wounded me, when she made mock of my verses in front of you? In front of you, Caesar. Do you remember?
Yes, Catullus. I know that she is no ordinary woman. There is a greatness about her. And she will be remembered because of you.
I have done well to praise her.
Yes, you have done well.
She She has been badly hurt. When one has been hurt very badly, one can do cruel things.
Who has hurt her?
You, Caesar.
I?
Yes. I've always known it. It is you she loves. She has not forgotten that you have loved her once, and so she sought revenge through me.
Can this be true?
That's why I've hated you. That's why I wrote the things I did, denouncing you. I have been jealous of you, Caesar. I jealous of you. It was foolish.
Tell me, Catullus, who are these friends of yours? Who is this Committee of 20?
All those letters were written by me alone. There is no Committee of 20. I have failed in all things.
No, my boy, I assure you, there you did not fail. Those bulletins of yours have done their damage. Hundreds of thousands have been aroused to patriotic hatred of me, the oppressor. My secret police arrest them every day.
Oh, forgive me. I am sorry for this. I respect you, Caesar.
You must rest now, my poor friend.
You will not go away.
No. I shall be here. He is sleeping. And during this last hour, I have paid my debt. He has been comforted at least. I have emptied my heart of thanks and praise to him. But if only I could communicate all that I owe to men like this. All my life long, boy and man, soldier and administrator, lover, father, son, sufferer and rejoicer, all the happiness I owe to the genius of poetry, all the wisdom and courage such men have given me, sustained me in despair, kept me alive to beauty and the joy of life. These are our poets. Many things remain unspoken. And now Catullus, too, is dead.
And now Catullus, too, is dead. Historians have demonstrated that Caesar arrived quite late to Cleopatra's reception. So late, in fact, that he surprised the Queen of Egypt in the arms of Mark Antony. Now the Ides of March are drawing on apace. On December 12th of this same year, Julius Caesar divorced his wife Pompeia, and the circumstance came about in this fashion. Note the following letter sent to Turnus on the 10th day of the month. I emerged from my bedchamber this morning to the music of women's voices. Last night, as you know, had occurred the ceremonies...
The ceremonies of the sacred mysteries of the good goddess. From time immemorial, the exclusive annual religious function conducted and attended by our Roman matrons of high birth. No man, not even I, has ever been allowed to see these secret rites, or to penetrate the sanctum of this holy ceremonial. Of course, the ritual goes on most of the night, so I wasn't in the least surprised that my wife and aunt had visitors this early in the morning.
This is the end.
Oh,
really, our most beautiful and sacred ceremony dragged into the mud.
I know, my dear Alina. If I hadn't seen him there with my own eyes, I'd never have believed it.
Well, personally, I think it's rather funny.
Pompeia, dear, you mustn't say such things.
Julian, if your nephew Caesar had any proper respect for religion or the old Roman way of life,
now,
instead of wasting his time on these newfangled irrigation projects and flood controls and...
Now, Alina, we all know your views on these subjects. The question is now, what shall be done with Clodia Pulcher and her brother?
Good morning, ladies. Oh. What of Clodia Pulcher?
Oh, good morning, nephew.
Good morning, great Caesar.
What is all this excitement? And don't tell me someone has abducted the Vestal Virgin.
Oh, the most terrible thing has happened, nephew. Last night, Clodia Pulcher introduced her brother, dressed as a votary, into the ceremonies of the good goddess.
What? What?
You mean in woman's costume?
You should have seen him, dear. Really, he made quite an attractive woman.
It has set religion back 1,000 years.
It's an outrage to Roman motherhood.
Now, tell me quite calmly, Aunt Julia, exactly how it happened.
Why, Caius, our singing had been going on for an hour. And the responses. And then suddenly he was recognized.
Some women flew at him and tore off his turban and veil.
Soon women were striking him from all sides. Others dashed about covering up the sacred things.
Poor Clodius. The way they scratched his pretty face.
No, really, Pompeia. The way you keep pitying the brute, one would think you were on his side.
Well, Clodius didn't mean any harm. It was just his idea of a joke.
It is not a matter to joke about, Pompeia.
I quite agree, Aunt Julia. I promise you I shall start a thorough investigation of this matter as soon as I get to the capital. Goodbye, ladies.
Good day.
Goodbye, nephew.
Goodbye, my wife.
Oh. Bye-bye, Caius, darling. Bye-bye.
Asinius, I suppose our secret police have kept the usual day-to-day reports on the activity of Clodius Pulcher?
Yes, Dictator.
Bring them here to me.
I have them ready. I was afraid that you would ask for a report on him this morning.
Why do you say afraid?
Read them, Caesar, and you will see.
Yes. I do see, Asinius. Why wasn't this sorry matter pointed out to me before?
Great Caesar, none of us had dared to tell you.
And it is verified that Clodius has visited my house in my absence on each of these occasions.
It is verified. And he wore the disguises provided for him by his sister, as it is reported.
Well. Well, well. Asinius, I have survived the Gallic Wars and the campaigns in Africa. I dare say I can survive the faithlessness of a woman. I have known a great many women in my life, Asinius.
Yes, Dictator.
One marriage in 100 is happy, my friend. This is one of those things that everyone knows and which no one says.
Yes, Dictator.
Given the nature of women and the nature of the passion which draws men and women together, what chance does marriage have of being happy? By marrying, we place our households into the hands of women. They extend their control as far as they are able over all our goods. Women wish only the warmth of a hearth and the shelter of a roof. And to protect this property, there is no deception, no rapacity to which they will not resort. All that they ask of a home beyond its shelter is that it be more ostentatious than that of a neighbor's wife. All that they ask for a children's happiness is that they be wealthily married.
There is much truth in what you say.
I believe wives consciously dread and despise their husbands. And bring their daughters up to live in such fear and contempt of men that most girls remain ignorant, joyless, and brutified all their days. Look at me, Asinius. I have constantly been victimized by women who have been made stupid by the greed and prejudice of their mothers. A man may have saved the state, directed the affairs of a world, and acquired an undying fame for wisdom, but to his wife he is still a witless fool. Oh, Pom. Hey, why? Why did you do it?
I am full of sadness, Caesar, that I should have been the bearer of these tidings.
Yes. Well, I am rid of her. You may issue an edict in my name saying that I shall divorce my wife tomorrow afternoon.
It shall be done.
My friend, let us console ourselves with philosophy. That is a realm which women have never entered, indeed in which they have never taken the faintest interest. And let us welcome that old age which frees us from the desire for their embraces. Embraces which must be paid for at the cost of all order in our lives and any tranquility in our minds.
Fortunately, I have reached that age.
Alas, I have not. What further business do we have before us?
The woman Clodia Pulcher has been brought as you directed.
Let her come in.
Yes, Dictator.
Please step inside.
You sent for me, mighty Caesar?
It is with regret that I must tell you, Clodia, that appeals have been lodged with me which urge that you and your brother be excluded from the city of Rome.
Where is my brother? What have you done with him?
He is under the care of my physician and unable to be moved at the present time. As you know, he happened to get into the path of some angry women. And you know what cruelty women are capable of.
The cruelty of women. That's a slur at me, isn't it? Because of Catullus,
you... You're touchy on that subject.
The only reason for which you punish me is that I refuse my love to the poet.
No blame attaches to a woman who, being loved, is unable to love in return. But a woman knows well the ways in which she may intensify or mitigate the sufferings of her lover. And neither the persuasion of reason nor the appeal to mercy altered your conduct to him. His gifts to Rome were of no less consequence than mine.
Punish me, then.
You and your brother are hereby banished from Rome. You are not to return on penalty of death.
I loved you once.
And I was once in love with you. Your real punishment, Clodia, is yet to come. An exile is the least of it. In a year or two, your beauty will be gone. And that, for a woman of your kind, is the hardest punishment of all. You may go now.
This is goodbye, then. You despise me, I understand that. But you have a responsibility toward me. You made me what I am. You, a monster, have made me a monster. I can endure my life in exile because I know that I shall be revenged. I have planted the seeds of rebellion. I have sharpened their knives, and I shall be revenged. And it will not be long. Hail and farewell, great Caesar. Health and long life to the dictator. And so I say goodbye.
Asinius, what other business do we have?
There is a gift that has come, and with it a note from the Queen of Egypt.
Another note, let me see. Oh. The usual. She begs my forgiveness. It was not her fault. The ardent Antony compromised her by blandishment and force and so forth. Where's the gift?
Here, dictator.
Oh. Yes. The juice of juniper berries mixed with wormwood and honey. It's an old Egyptian remedy, Asinius. Guaranteed to cure baldness. It'll keep your head purple for a week. Yes, do you have your salus?
Yes, Caesar.
And write me down a note to be delivered to the Queen of Egypt. My dear Cleopatra, you are long since forgiven for your indiscretion. I know my nephew's habits very well. And thank you, my pearl, my lotus, for the magic salve you have sent me. Now, I am neither a doctor nor a magician, but this one thing I know. A man can have either hair or brains, but he can't have both. I'm quite handsome enough as I am, and since the immortal gods gave me good sense, I think they didn't mean for me to have curls. I am sending you, my star and phoenix, a bottle of Syrian perfume. And since I am disengaged, I shall call at your villa later in the evening. You still have my heart. There's no woman in the world who can compare with a great queen of Egypt.
There is no woman in the world who can compare with the great queen of Egypt. And now a fragment of the last letter written to Turnus. On the morning of the 15th day, the Ides of March, in the year 44 B.C. It begins, "By the immortal gods, I am angry.
Each day new plots against me are discovered. It is charged that I am a thief of liberty, monster of greed, and murderer of the Republic. In the eyes of my enemies, there is no good in me. I had a dream of death last night, the same dream that has come to me many times before. In it, the dead call out to me in mockery from their grave clothes, and generations still unborn cry out in agony and pain. Life. Life is this mystery that we dare not say whether it is good or bad, senseless or controlled. When I regard the clownish parade of mortal life, I sometimes wonder if the universe knows that we are here. Flood or folly, fire or madness may destroy us at any time. And yet, there is a pattern. I have for many years, dear friend Turinus, had your example to profit by. Since the day that you were wounded, I have been nourished by your wisdom and your patience and your gaiety of heart. There must be purpose in a world that can provide us with examples of such courage. My wife, Calpurnia, had advised me not to go to the Senate today. The wild winds of March are blowing, and with them the customary rumors of plots and counterplots. But I shall go to the Senate. I'm expected there, sharp on the hour, and I must not be late.
Here Caesar's last letter breaks off. We have the account of his assassination, of course, handed down by Suetonius. When he saw that he was surrounded on all sides by drawn daggers, he wrapped his head in his robe, at the same time drawing the folds about his feet with his left hand. One of the caskers plunged a dagger into him just below the throat, and when he tried to rise, he was held down by another stab. In this manner, then, he was stabbed 23 times. He said no word, merely groaned at the first stroke. But when Marcus Brutus fell upon him, he said in Greek, "You too, my son." All the conspirators took themselves off and left him lying there, dead. Well, as I said to begin with, it is by no means certain that those letters are genuine. But they are interesting, and I offer them for what they are worth. Thank you for your attention.
I am sure we are all grateful to Professor Willard for coming here today. May I remind you to pass out to the rear of the hall? Oh, yes. The administration wishes me to announce that there will be a football rally tonight in the gymnasium.
You have been listening to The Ides of March, an NBC Theater production of the Thornton Wilder novel. If you wish to increase your knowledge and appreciation of literature, we suggest that you might enjoy the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC Theater. For full information, write to NBC Theater in care of one of the following universities or colleges: University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky; University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma; Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas; Washington State College, Pullman, Washington; University of Arizona, Tucson, Arizona; Texas College of Arts and Industries, Kingsville, Texas; or Brooklyn College, Brooklyn, New York. You also have a chance to win a set of the famous Encyclopedia Britannica. Several of the universities and colleges offering these courses are giving the Encyclopedia as prizes to the students doing the best work. Enroll in a supervised course and you may be one of the fortunate ones to win the Encyclopedia Britannica. Be with us at the NBC Theater next week for a production of Robert Penn Warren's highly dramatic novel, At Heaven's Gate, and the following week for two stories by Catherine Ann Porter, Pale Horse, Pale Rider, and The Flowering Judas. The Ides of March was adapted for the NBC Theater by Brainerd Duffield and Emerson Crocker. Our intermission speaker was Edward Weeks. In today's cast, Whitfield Connor was heard as Caesar, Parley Bear was the Professor, Lynn Allen, Claudia, Ben Wright, Catullus, Georgia Bacchus, Julia, Dora Singleton was Pompeia, Jan Arvan, Asinius, Maya Gregory was Cleopatra, Larry Dobkin, Antony, Ida Reese Marin, Elena, and James Nusser, the Chairman. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The director of the NBC Theater is Andrew C. Love. What's on NBC today? Well, Sam Spade gets an assist from television in solving his latest surprising caper. And it all adds up to better entertainment during The Adventures of Sam Spade. And also today, you'll hear Helen Hayes and Walter Abel on Theater Guild on the Air. Today's Theater Guild comedy drama is Another Language. So be sure to hear Sam Spade and Theater Guild on the Air later today on NBC. You're tuned for the stars on NBC.